Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about redesigning your garden to make it easier to manage without losing the color or the curb appeal. Our guest is Carrie Ann Mendez. She's an expert gardener and author of books on gardening. Her landscaping company is Perennial Yours, focusing on low-maintenance perennial gardening. What do you want to know about redesigning your garden? What questions do you have for Carrie? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can post, as always, your questions and your pictures on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be with you.
Well, redesigning a garden sounds like a major undertaking. Big project alert. Can you walk us through this process of a garden makeover, and when is the right time to start this whole project?
Oh, well, I'm smiling as you say that, because I think that's the challenge that a lot of us feel. The idea, both the emotional decisions and the idea of just rolling up our sleeves and marching out there, is overwhelming. So most of us do nothing. It's one of those, we just get frozen in our tracks. So I'm hoping that some of the things I'm going to share today will give you a skip to your step, and you'll feel like, hey, I can take little bites and make my gardens even more gorgeous. And as much as gorgeous and less work, they must be more sustainable as far as, you know, lower water, lower fertilizer, more pollinator friendly. So that's what I embrace. Let me start with, you said, what are the steps?
Yeah, what is step one? Yeah.
Well, you know, the first step I say is actually go back inside the house. And I mean that by, I think one of the first things we need to do is to go inside our home and look out the windows of our most often used rooms in the house and see if there's a beautiful garden or some type of focal point in the view that's framed by the window. Because, you know, most people just think, well, I'm going to start over there, or my shovel dropped over there, so that's a good place to start redoing or putting in a new bed. But I think we need to put more thought into it. If we really want a garden that is going to give us maximum enjoyment, it's got to be one that we can also enjoy from inside the house, including winter landscapes, not one that's back behind the garage, which we never see. So we can get into the details about plant material and design, but as the real estate market always says, location, location, location. And not only will a garden be more frequently enjoyed out of the from rooms that you're usually in the house, and we're also going to talk about the front landscape in a second, but I'm talking about other areas of the property. Start by looking out those most commonly used rooms windows and decide, does there need to be a really interesting garden there that I can enjoy, not just when I'm outside in the gardens? It will also increase property value, because if you ever have to sell your home, when you have that wonderful, sublime selling point for you as people are walking through the house and then they're gazing out windows in beautiful rooms that are frequently used, you're adding that pleasure point and ideally the price point that you want. It certainly worked for me when we had to do this.
And when you're washing dishes and looking out the kitchen sink window, it's like you have a gaze on your face because you're doing something monotonous.
Right.
What can we do to start thinking about getting color there, but not with all of that work that really goes into so much of gardening, getting out there every day and watering, for instance?
Right. Well, you know, the plants I'm going to be mentioning as we go now through this, how we go about creating a glorious view that's so much less work, is I insist on what I call superhero and supermodel plants. So these are plants that are not prima donnas, that don't need me to slave over them to be able to enjoy beautiful color. And there are great plants out there, and I will share some of those that I think, you know, provide months and months of color without me dilly-dallying over them. And I need plants that also, as we already said, require less water. All these things that we want, more sustainable plantings. So when I talk about now making the pick, you know, picking these plants,
mm-hmm.
I think most people automatically, well, maybe you don't, I don't know, think perennials. They're like, okay, well, perennials are a good thing because they live year after year. I don't have to plant them each year like I do annuals. And so that's typically what I find people think of first. Okay, what perennials can I plant in an area that will maximize color and minimize input? And when I use the word input, I'm going to now at this point just define that as low my input as far as maintenance, but also low water,
mm-hmm.
low fertilizer. Please stop using those pesticides, you know, organic approach to our gardens. And some of the best perennials, if I just want to start out with what I think for sun, and then I'll say a few for shade.
Yeah, who are these rock stars?
Oh, they're so good. They're so, and you know, by the way, I have to mention, I was just in Wisconsin 2 weeks ago. I was speaking at a symposium at the Rotary Botanical Gardens.
Yeah.
And then the next day, I did a presentation at Ulbrich Botanical Gardens.
Mm.
So your zone and my zone here in southern Maine, we're very, very similar.
Oh.
Because that's where I am, and, you know, I was just
right
there. I was going through. And so the plants I'm going to mention certainly would be really great choices for your region. So as far as some of the rock horse ones for sun, the number one, the most awarded, nationally and internationally awarded perennial to date is a hardy geranium called Geranium Roseanne. And I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with Geranium Roseanne, which is hardy to zone 5, although I would easily push it to zone 4 without even blinking. It's a very tough geranium. But this is a geranium that is the first ever sterile geranium, which means it doesn't ever put energy into seed production like the pink and white hardy geranium.
Hmm.
This blue-purple geranium just powers on right until October with no deadheading on your part in constant flowers.
It doesn't even sound real.
I know. Some people like, Carrie, you're not fessing up here all the way. I'm like, no, this is amazing. That's why it's gotten so many awards. Now, I will put my little finger up in the air quickly because people say, but wait a minute, Carrie. If it's sterile, what about the butterflies and the bees? What is the benefit to pollinators? And I'll be the first to say this is not a perennial that you would be putting in to benefit that population. That's not going to benefit that group, but I would never put in just plants that would not benefit pollinators. That's one among 60 to 70% of the plants I use that are pollinator friendly free. You know, that are pollinator friendly. But if you want the rock star, number one, I'm going to point at Geranium Roseanne for the perennial. It can do sun to part shade.
Okay.
And I'll mention one or two more.
Yeah,
for sun, and then
keep them coming. Name drop, please.
Oh, my God. Well, another one that I use so much is, it's really getting a lot of reviews right now. It's a variety of Allium. Again, both Geranium Roseanne and the variety I just mentioned, Allium, are both highly deer and rabbit resistant because we don't want to be dealing with trying to keep the four-footer critters from munching our plants all the time.
Yeah.
So certainly alliums are wonderful because they're so drought tolerant, they're pollinator friendly, all these great things we want. The difference with this one called Allium Millennium is that it has a much larger purpley pink flower head. It has big, bold, strappy blue-green leaves, nice, tight clump former, about 18 inches tall, and so it just... And it'll bloom for easily 6-7 weeks without reseeding all over the place.
Hmm.
And it makes just a really striking display in a sun-to-part-sun garden.
All right. Can we get one more here before we head into a break?
Let me add one more for sun, and then afterwards I'll just mention a few for shade.
Yes.
You know, I love the coneflowers. And a lot of people do, but I have become very picky about coneflowers because many of them are short-lived. They just don't make it through the winters.
Yeah.
They're genetic junk, if I may say so. But there are a few that are outstanding and have been highly rated. And one of the ones that has gotten a lot of press is one called Milkshake. that is a white variety of a coneflower introduced originally, I think, from Chicago Botanic Gardens. And there are some others. The native one called Rocky Top. Rocky Top is an amazing, very beautiful pink one with very, very skinny petals that are spaced quite wide apart. So it looks a little different than other coneflowers. And it's another native one in the Tennesseeansis species.
Yeah, real pop of color. And as we're looking here online, you know, really nice structure and interest shaping. So there's a lot of interesting, eye-catching things there. We've been visiting with garden designer Carrie Ann Mendez. She's the author of a number of books and articles on gardening, and she has a landscaping company that focuses on low-maintenance gardens. Is your garden too much work? Maybe you want to cut down on all that frequent watering. We'd love to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us for more garden talk here on the Ideas Network. The Larry Mueller Show devotes every Friday to your gardening questions. You can listen to past shows at WPR.org. Click on over to the Shows tab to find the Larry Mueller Show. On Monday, Larry's back with the physical therapy team. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum will be here to answer your physical rehab and orthopedic questions. Hope you'll join in on Monday. Now back to your questions on Garden Talk with our garden design expert, Carrie Ann Mendez. Are you thinking about changing your garden next season, wondering if you can get a better result with less effort? Tell us about your gardening challenges at 800-642-1234. You can post your questions and photos to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to a caller, Renee in Janesville. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Renee.
Hi.
I just got my first house, and it turns out that you get a garden with a house. I'm so overwhelmed. The people that we bought it from spent about 3 hours a day, and I don't have 3 hours a day to spend in my garden.
Right.
Is there any way to, like, start figuring out what I have?
Well, I mean, my very first thing I think of whenever I consult with people, and similar, just what you just said, is I think so many of us feel that we have to accept what the prior owner did, and therefore we almost collapse in the process of trying to maintain what they felt was a good choice for them. So I've already heard you say you're willing to start making some changes that fit into your current lifestyle and not what fit the prior person's. And in doing that, I would, and I'll answer your question 1 second, but I would go to what I just said before. The gardens that you're going to keep would be, or the garden you're going to keep, certainly one would be one you'd be easily enjoying from a, you know, commonly used room in your house. And secondly, the front of your house, curb appeal, striking, important, good, super plants there. In order to try to identify what you have, you know, I have found that I used to work for years at family-owned garden centers, and what I would find that many people would bring in pictures that they took in their gardens, click, 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 and they'd show me the images, and I could tell them exactly what they have. It might not be the specific cultivar, but someone could easily just say, here's my list of plants, what do I have here? And I'm happy to do that, and many consultants are happy to help you with that. They're all also, I don't know, with your region, with your extension office, Master Gardeners and others, there are people, at least in my region here in Maine, in the Boston region, that you can hire for a reasonable fee who could come to your property and actually walk through side by side and help you identify exactly what you have going on there. And what might be the right plant for that site, or really is an invasive, it really shouldn't have been there from the get-go, and help you sort that out. Because it is overwhelming when you don't even know the plants. Where do you even start? So ideally, if you could find someone like, you know, myself or others, I know they do this, where you could probably find names from your master gardeners, your extension office there, and they could give you some leads on some ways to find some help.
And Carrie, when is the right time to get a professional designer involved? Or is it possible to tackle a redesign all on your own?
It depends on the amount of time and the amount of interest you have. As far as timing, you know, a lot of times I think the fall is ideal. In the spring, many of us in the industry are just swamped. Everyone's in line for, you know, everyone wants our time and attention and our advice then. What people sometimes forget is that I don't necessarily, and other people in my business don't have to see a plant in bloom to know what it is. We may not know the flower color, the specific type, but we're going to know the plant, the shrub, the plant, the whatever, so that we can take a look and I can walk through a garden even in September and I can look at what's going on there and get an idea what might be able to be done in the fall, which is a great time for moving, dividing, getting rid of, you know, donating, selling plants. So really I find late summer, fall to be a great time to be thinking about some changes. In the winter, it doesn't hurt to maybe put together your wish list of plants that you'd like to see in front of your home. I mean, one of the, I think, best resources for plants with great images and great help, it's a catalog company, a mail order company actually based out of Ohio called Bluestone Perennials. They have been in the family business for so many years. They sell over 1,000 different varieties of plants. Most of them are zone 5 or colder, which is where you are, Wisconsin, your region. And, you know, going to their website, and I'm not saying purchase necessarily from, I love those guys. I love them. They're good friends of mine, but I believe in supporting local family-owned businesses first, garden centers. But if you can't find something, I find Bluestone to be the garden, the mail order company of choice, and using their catalog that they provide, which gives you all these colors, everything about the plant, so you can look through and say, oh, I like that, I like that. So you could come up with your list of plants that you might want to add to your landscape, and it might mean also taking some non-worthy plants out of the landscape.
Yeah. Well,
and
Renee,
that can be done in the winter.
Yeah, thank you so much for that call, Bill from Barneveld. Bill, hi.
Hi. I'm going to start by quoting Mark Twain, who observed that most problems come from solutions. So I'm sitting at my office desk looking out the windows to kind of a half moon outside the window, and I decided to tear up all the sod and just try to plant some sort of perennials there and maybe some things that would attract the birds and the butterflies that I can look at out my window. So I did that. I did my best to put down a kill layer even after I took the sod up. And then I put down really dense quantities of, like, you know, wildflower and sort of prairie seed, you know, commercially bought stuff. But I realized the problem is it's right against the house, and the house faces east, even with some shade. So it only gets full sun for, you know, depending on the time of year, a few hours, maybe 4 hours in the morning, and then it's in shade the rest of the day. So what I found, this wasn't enough, I think, for the prairie seed type wildflower seeds, and it's just been overwhelmed by grass and creeping Charlie. So now I have a weed bed out my window. And I wonder if you have any suggestions for converting it. What sort of, do I need shade perennials or sun perennials?
Yeah. Gosh, that's one of the first things, and I hate to, you know, but I know what you're, what has happened is you haven't matched the right plant to right spot. So, and light being one of the predominant conditions that we're going to try to match, as well as your soil type, soil health. But most, if you think about it, most prairie plants, meadow gardenings, are going to want that beating hot sun with fast-draining soil, not clay. They're going to need a fast-draining, hot, sunny area. That's not the location you're working with. But it doesn't mean you can't transform that into a beautiful, low-maintenance area that you can enjoy from your office window. Well, before I mention some plants to do, if the majority of that space right now that you're looking at, and you'd say more than 60% of that garden right now is weeds, I would totally start over. I would, depending how you feel about it, I would weed whack the whole thing down hard. I would cover that space up with some plastic, black plastic, to basically eliminate any water or light, and basically kill it, because I don't want to use herbicides, chemical herbicides or anything, and just kill it. Just let it be done so that next spring you can start over with better plants, and you're not, and you will have killed the weeds, so they're not going to be, oh my gosh, bothering you the following year. Does that make sense from that part? I mean, I don't know how many weeds.
Put black plastic work on right now before the snow falls, basically?
Yeah. Okay. Starve it. It's done. I mean, it's finished. I would just seal it off. I mean, I don't know how big it is. You could go in and just hand or with a spade start, you know, pulling, you know, getting it, you know, ripping stuff out. But the problem I have with that is the more you disturb that existing soil, the more dormant weeds you're going to bring up in the process. So my thing is let's disturb the soil as least as possible. Let, you know, those weed seeds lie dormant deeper down in the soil. You're going to kill everything from the top down. That's, organic matter will break down. And then in the spring, you can start over and put in better plants with the idea that you've killed. Just leave that thing sealed down even through the into the spring until you're ready to peel it back and then start working on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and if you have any plant suggestions, I have my pen in hand.
Yeah, okay. What are these A-listers for part sun and shade?
Okay. Well, what you just described on that side of the house with very little direct sun, and it's only in the morning, that's not hot sun. That's you're really gardening in shade, to part shade. And so one of my favorite, I mean, I love ornamental grasses, and one of my favorite ones that people, we sell it so fast at garden centers when they're under display beds, it's a ornamental grass for shade, and the common name is Japanese forest grass. It also goes by another common name called Hakone, Hakone grass. And it's only, it tops out about 18 inches, and it's a very sweeping, cascading grass. It flows, it moves in the breeze, so it would be used towards the front of the garden bed, all right? And it comes in all different blade colors, from pure golden yellow to green and gold to green and white to solid green to green, white, and pink. You have all these beautiful styles of the lovely blades that you can add color and both movement to, and it's a clump-forming grass. It's not going to start taking over the bed. It's very well-behaved. Another plant I would use, you're probably familiar with astilbe, right, with the plumes, all different.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
A-S-T-I-L-B-E.
Mm-hmm.
But here's my big thing. Because I'm into conserving water, there's only one group of species group of astilbe that I use now that can tolerate inconsistent water and still will not fry out and crisp up like other varieties. And it's any astilbe in the chinensis group. And I'll spell that for everyone. It's C-H-I-N-E-N-S-I-S. And this group of astilbes that have all different plume colors, from purple and red and white and peach and all that, these are much more drought tolerant than other varieties of astilbe. They're just as deer resistant and rabbit resistant, but now we've got a plant that can be planted in lower light. Depending on the variety, you can have those that start in June, other varieties start in July to bloom, others start in August to bloom. So we can have these waves of beautiful colored plumes on top of, you know, on astilbes that don't need the same amount of water as other varieties. So now, just for the two I just mentioned, sweeping grasses with plumes of purples, whites, pinks through the summer, and then if you add one more tier, which is usually what everyone thinks of, hosta.
Mm.
You could add frosty blue leaf hostas. You could use variegated ones. The two tips I'd give with hostas, and I know I'm giving a lot of information here, but we want less work, right? If you do not want the same problems with slugs and snails that chomp the leaves of hosta, then limit yourself to hosta that have very puckered or quilted leaves, as we say. So these are, you know, they look quilted. They're very thick. They're thicker leaves, so they kind of pucker up. The thicker the leaf of a hosta, the less likely it is going to be damaged by slugs and snails, where you get those stripped holes or whatever.
Yeah.
So just by pitching the leaf style in a hosta, you can dramatically eliminate the pest situation. And deer also tend to kind of jump over those, if you will. Deer will go for a thinner leafed, usually a ribbed leafed hosta, and shred it like lettuce. But when you get into that thicker leaf, it makes them work more. You know, and they don't have upper teeth anyway, up incisors anyway. So we might as well, if they're going to start munching our hosta, let's have them gum themselves hard if they have to, with a big thick leaf, you know, hosta. Does that help?
very much. That's great, especially the first two suggestions. I think I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, good luck on your 2.0 garden. Thanks so much for the call. We're talking with Carrie Ann Mendez. She's a garden designer and author of The Right Size Flower Garden. Simplify your outdoor space with smart design solutions and plant choices. We're going to go to Jackie in Maquanago. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there.
What do you have to ask?
Well, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you.
What I have to ask is that we have lovely trees here in Wisconsin, and our pioneer ancestors loved black walnut tree. Mm. And not everything can be planted underneath the black walnut tree. And I have gone to the university extension. I've gotten massive lists of what should work and what shouldn't work. But I guess I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
You know, I have been more and more surprised at what will survive under the black walnut trees. And, you know, you can get lists, as you have mentioned, but there are quite a number, including hostas and others, that can duke it out there against that toxic situation, especially from the roots. I tell people sometimes we can garden a little farther away, not right under the crown, maybe around the edges of the trees, so we're not really directly over where the toxins from the roots are as concentrated. So, you know, I would have to go myself to a list and see which ones would be available, especially in my area or your area. But I find there are more than I ever thought, and some that have survived even when they said they weren't supposed to survive. You know, sometimes it's just pushing the envelope and giving it a try with one plant at a time so we don't lose a huge investment if they're killed, and just see what works. I wish I had better advice for you on that one. I mean, we don't have as many black walnut trees here, and at least in the main area.
Right. So maybe the coneflower is your superhero for that area?
Well,
coneflower
is going to want a lot of sun, and that's not going to be ideally what you're talking. You're trying to plant under the tree, correct?
You know, we have a one-acre front yard, and that's where the largest shade trees are of all. And we've had some success with the coneflower, but you're right. They do like the full sun to look healthier and to be a better plant. I was just wondering if there was any superhero for the black walnut tree.
You know what? I'd have to quickly Google to see out of my list which ones, and I don't have that right in front of me, and I'm so sorry. So I can't help you there unless I can do my research between the next ad, and then I can come up with a few I can mention for you from my list that would do well. But right now, I don't have a quick answer for you.
Well, Jackie, thanks so much for your call. Keep on listening. We might be able to crack that.
Yeah.
And, let's go to Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for this show. It's perfect timing for us baby boomers here. I wanted to mention you talked about a catalog, and there is another catalog that is excellent, and it's from a Wisconsin company called Prairie Restorations. And you can go from sun to shade, clay to sand, grasses, perennials, ground covers. And so that's really, it's a great resource for gardeners.
And then, what's the name of it again?
Prairie Restorations.
Got it. Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
All right.
And the other comment I had was, I'm a wildlife gardener, and I've been thinking of just kind of trying to convert more into shrubs and ground covers, never get rid of the flowers and that, but I'm thinking, for me, that seems like a less working area, like just having more shrubs and ground covers. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. I mean, I started with the perennials, but as I'm aging, baby boomer myself, I am embracing flowering shrubs and ground covers. You know, some of the ones that I just love, and many of them are natives, but I certainly love, I don't know if you're familiar with Fothergilla, commonly called bottle brush shrub. Oh, my gosh. And I saw it when I was at Old Brick and Rotary. They had a number of them all planted through the display beds. This plant, this shrub, which if you prune it once every 5 years, that's a lot, it's commonly called bottle brush shrub. It has fragrant white flowers in the spring, and it flowers like a forsythia. So it has flowers before the leaves open up. So you have this great structure of branching with these creamy white flowers. Then it leaps out either to green leaves or frosty blue leaves. I have the frosty blue-leafed ones here around my home here in Maine. So they look really gorgeous blue through the summer. And then, this is the key, and this is what I saw all around the botanical gardens a few weeks ago and here in my property, the leaves turn brilliant red, orange, and yellow like a sugar maple. And so many of us in the industry are using these as a replacement for burning bush that are invasive, because we still want that bold display of fiery foliage in the fall, but we want a plant that's non-invasive. We don't have to keep whacking down hard to try to keep it pruned into a manageable height. And bottle brush shrub is a go-to plant, amazing, smaller shrub. Depending on the cultivar, they range from 3 feet tall to 8 feet tall at maturity. Another one that you're going to see so many more, again, we're looking at drought-tolerant shrubs as well. The other big shrub for native shrubs are in the ninebark family, Physocarpus. Are you familiar with that group of shrubs?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we have some, and I just love them. They're very beautiful. Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned baby boomers. There is, in the industry, there's a huge movement to take commonly sold plants that are really popular, that are larger in size, and breed them down into smaller, compact plants that could be used in smaller scale settings. You know, I'm in a condominium here in Maine, or in containers, especially for millennials who are choosing now, many, to live more in urban settings where they're doing small decks or patios, community gardens. They need plants that fit smaller spaces without compromising the beauty of flowers or fruit or edible production.
Yeah.
So in that ninebark family, there is one called Tiny Wine, and it is so fast of a seller. It only gets 3 to 4 feet tall and wide. It has lovely burgundy purple leaves with soft pinkish white flowers that the pollinators love, that then turn to berries that the birds love, and it's highly drought tolerant, and it's native. And, you know, you mentioned ground covers. This is one I use so much to sweep around as a mulch, if you will, as a living ground cover mulch weed suppressant in my garden, especially towards shade, is one called Leptonilla. And there's no common name for it, otherwise I'd give it to you. But it's L-E-P, as in Peter, T-I-N-E-L-L-A. And this is like a little silver burgundy and deep green 2-inch tall ground cover that has a very dense leaf habit, so it really keeps weeds from germinating through it. And it looks beautiful sweeping around shrubs, around perennials, even around your annuals, and it makes a living carpet that keeps your weeds down and also helps reduce evaporation from our soil. So, and where you find that one I just mentioned, it's usually sold in ground cover lines like Jeepers Creepers or Steppables. That's where you usually find it at our garden centers, in those 4-inch squares. That's how it's sold.
Well, Pat, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Program. Bye.
And, you know, Carrie, you remind me so much of a tough love gardener. You know, if a plant's not working, stop babying it, stop making excuses, pull it out, give it to a friend, move on.
Yeah.
Your approach is really liberating, but change is hard, you know, for many gardeners. We have emotions with our plants. How do you do a reality check with your garden?
Well, this is what I did. Because I did the same thing when I had a right size after, unfortunately, my husband had a bad accident, and I had to care for him, and I couldn't care for the gardens the same way. So I had to come to grips with making those decisions if I had to escort a plant off my property, give it to a friend, a plant sale. And I came to the conclusion that these plants were not my children, and they were not my pets. Therefore, if this plant was really driving me crazy, was an underachiever, just totally didn't pick up after itself, just drove me nuts, I was going to stop making excuses. I was going to dig that plant out. I was going to, as long as it wasn't invasive or not a problem, I would find another home for it, you know. And now I freed myself from going nutty over these plants that were driving me crazy. And then you'd say, oh, but this plant was from my Aunt Julie, and I can't get rid of it, even though it's so disease-prone. It drives me crazy. I say, okay, we're going to take a good photograph of that plant. We're going to make a nice picture of it. We're going to put it on our refrigerator so we can appreciate it there, and then we're going to get rid of that silly plant out of our garden. Move on. Life is too short. Too short.
But what about second chances? Because, you know, sometimes one season something really underperforms in your flower bed. Do you give it another season to redeem itself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believe in second chances, absolutely. But, after we get to the third and the fourth year and we're still scratching our heads and we're frowning at the plant, it's time to stop. It's time to say, even though it may look stunning in my neighbor's yard right over the fence, if it's not working where you have it and or maybe where you moved it a second time, then just move on. You know, uncle, do something different and be happier. You know, try or maybe here's another thing I'm doing in the right size garden. I'm realizing that not everything out there in the gardens have to be a living thing. I'm using some very interesting ornamental, architecturally striking pieces that can be in a spot where I used to have a sweep of plants. Maybe it's some type of art piece, statuary, interesting boulder with lichen on it. Whatever, I'm finding that that I don't have to always have a living thing to provide that interest. And now, especially with some of these neat pieces I'm adding and vessels I'm adding to my garden, they're providing four seasons of stunning interest with very little input from me. So, you know, that's another thing I'm moving towards. Not that I'm wanting a crazy, you know, pieces all over the place garden, but I think some well-picked pieces can really add drama to a garden with very little input from our part or from other, you know, watering and all that.
Well, if we are starting from scratch in part of our yard, where should we look to for inspiration and know that we're getting ideas that are within our abilities and fit the amount of time and money we have to devote to the space? Because a lot of these books and things we see online can be pie in the sky, really.
I know. Well, you know, I love going on regional garden tours that are sponsored by different groups, especially for those people who have done it themselves and not from a landscaper who's come in. And not that I love landscapers, I'm in the industry, but I find that I get a lot of inspiration from going on regional garden tours that are hosted by garden clubs or different organizations. I also find the Garden Conservancy, if you, you check Garden Conservancy, you can see across the United States, they have open gardens in all different areas that I think it's like $7 to pay per garden, or you can join and become a member of Garden Conservancy like I am, and you get the opportunity to visit a lot of these gardens at no charge. But they can be a wealth of information. And you know what? Your local botanical gardens, especially with showing you examples of xeric gardening. So here's a space that is very, very, very low water that can also take incredible sun and heat. The displays set up at our wonderful botanical gardens and arboretums are priceless for teaching us how to create a combination or put together a combination of plants for a site that we're trying to plant. I mean, talk about a great example. Take your pictures with your camera, write down the names because the names are on the little plant tags right in front of you.
Yep.
And come up with a grouping of those plants that you like and go get them at the garden center and plant them. I mean, those are ideas that I would have. I'm going to put in a plug and it's selfless, I know, but in January I'm doing the second of national gardening webinars that I've started, and I just did one a few weeks ago that had 600 gardeners from the West Coast to the East Coast, all over the country, and I was teaching them on radical perennials for all different sites. And my one in January, on January 26th, is Inspired Garden Designs from Gardens in Canada, England, and the United States. And I'm going to be featuring these great gardens, many of them I've been to, and talking about this is what makes this garden design-wise work.
Hmm.
It can even work in a smaller backyard or in courtyard. These are the lessons I want you to see from these amazing gardens that you can then take pieces and apply it to your own wonderful space in your own yard. So if any of your listeners are interested, they can check out that webinar. They do not have to attend live because everyone gets a link to the lecture with handouts and all that within 48 hours. Everyone gets their own link. They can watch it at any time, you know, as many times as they want. But that might be, you know, again, I know it's a self-promotion piece, but it is on garden design. And from a perspective of a health strip, no-fuss gardener, and what we can take from gardens and apply it to our own space realistically. And that's what I'll be teaching through in January.
We've been talking with garden design expert Carrie Ann Mendez. Her latest book is The Right Size Flower Garden, Simplify Your Outdoor Space with Smart Design Solutions and Plant Choices. She is a tough love gardener. If the plant isn't working for you, move on, dig it up. Are you at that tipping point with your garden? Maybe you want to redo a portion so it doesn't require so much of your attention? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Larry on today's Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We'll be back after a short break. Your gardening questions are always front and center every Friday on the Larry Mueller Show. Be sure to join us next Friday on Garden Talk. Lisa Johnson will be back helping you transition your garden from fall to winter. She's also will be taking your gardening questions. Now let's return to Carrie Ann Mendez. She says gardening shouldn't control your life, unless you want it to, of course. Do you feel like gardening is taking up too much of your time? Do you want to figure out some lower maintenance plant options? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Therese in Madison. Hi, Therese.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I have a question. I'm hoping you can help me.
Okay.
I have a sidewalk in the front that it's lined with hostas on both sides. It's very striking, and actually I've had neighbors come over, and we've passed some of those clumps over to them. But there's a section about 2 feet on one side that for some reason every year just seems to not necessarily go dormant, but it will not grow very high. And the rest of the sidewalk line, you know, the stretch, is about 2 feet high, and mm-hmm. which is pretty high. But I mean, they get really nice and big and round. But this one section stays very, very short, like they're new plants. And I have tried digging it all out and putting in new soil and replacing it with different hostas, but for some reason that one section just will not grow, and I'm hoping you have an answer.
And so when you dug the hosta out that weren't growing very well, did you notice mm-hmm. anything about the soil area? Was the soil the same? I mean,
this is a fairly new thing. We've been here 17 years, and this uh-huh. started about 8 years ago.
And this is in the whole line, so it's right in the line. It's not the end or anything like that. It's right, say, midway in the lineup going up, and it's a one little section that just never seems to do well.
Yes, and like I said, this has been in recent years. It all of a sudden started. I thought maybe there might be a bug infestation, so I dug it all out, and I dug out the soil and put in fresh soil. But it keeps doing it, and my next step would be just to take all the hostas out, but I really hate to do that because it's really very striking.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I mean, I was going to say, well, if it's at the end, maybe it's dogs peeing on it. But, it, you know, at the end of the walk, that was causing them to be having issues. But if you've checked and when you dug those out, there was no chewing on the roots, so it wasn't voles or something like that. You didn't notice anything about the roots being damaged?
No.
It would be weird. It would just be going to one spot.
Yes, it has been very weird. In this area of the country, we have had infestations with Japanese beetles, and I know that larvae can get into, you know, into the soil. I thought maybe that might be a problem, or maybe an ant colony, but I didn't see anything when I dug it up.
Yeah, I mean, you would have noticed if there was some type of, obviously, something going on in the soil from insects or grubs or whatever. You've got me stumped. I mean, and it gets the same amount of water. It doesn't have any additional more heat from where it is. So there's no other cultural conditions that would affect that area other than that little group just never seems to go.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, even when I put new ones in there, they won't grow very high either. You know, it's like just for some reason there's stumps there. So I was hoping that maybe you'd have a solution, but I agree. It's really kind of a, you know, just a, it's a mind-boggler.
And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's some kind of really dramatic change in soil pH that's affecting them so they're not growing as strong. But why would it be just in that one area along the sidewalk if there wasn't any other different influence on that space? Maybe that's a space now that calls for some type of striking object. You've got me stumped. You said nothing's happening as far as munching on the roots. Nothing's happening as far as the soil conditions that you can see visibly as far as critters. It's in the same area as far as, so it's not getting any additional fertilizer or other type of input into the soil in that space that would influence its growing or soil pH. You got me. I don't know.
Well, Therese, good luck with good luck with the hosta mystery there, and thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Zoe and Amory. Oh, it's Amory. I'm sorry, Amory here. Yeah. hey, Zoe.
Hi.
Sorry about that.
Carrie Ann, I loved what you just said about if a garden is driving you nuts, tear it out. And I'm kind of at that point. I have over 100 irises that were my grandmother's, and they're at least from the 1960s. Mm. And that they're a beautiful, beautiful color, and I arranged them. I made a circle garden about 20 feet in diameter, and I arranged it like a Indian grass basket, so I have these rows that kind of spiral and wrap around the circle from the center.
Wow.
And when it's in bloom, it's just absolutely gorgeous. From the street, you just have this big wave of color. But it's so much work. Irises, I'm a mulcher, and I use a lot of native plants. Mm-hmm. And having to keep the weeds out of these is back-breaking work.
Mm. Yeah.
I want to tear the whole thing out, and you kind of gave me the energy to do that. But can you come up with a way that I could still? What I don't like about iris gardens is when people plant them is they are so much work. They just put in a little bit of them around their mailbox, and it looks like quite an understatement to me. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions that I could still make a really nice presentation with these irises, but not such a big undertaking.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful that you have such a collection, and it sounds beautiful what you've done. But as I say in my own life, life changes, and I've had some major changes in my life, and I'm willing, after a lot of procrastination many times for me, I'm finally just, I get to the breaking point, and I have to make some changes. It doesn't mean everything has to be ripped out. That's not what I'm suggesting. But maybe what you can do is select some of your very favorites that you have and keep those, not in the same style, perhaps, that you've just said with that amount of space. It sounds like it's just a lot of irises there. But pick some definitely you want to keep and reuse in your garden, and maybe you replant them. Maybe you use it in an area where you put in some really nice native ornamental grasses, like little bluestem grass that would give you a sweeping, a different texture to the foliage. You know what little bluestem looks like?
Yeah, I have some of that in my garden.
Okay, well, they're going to like very similar conditions. You're talking about the German bearded iris, right?
You know, I'm assuming so. It's, like I said, it was from my grandmother from the 1960s. They're quite large. They get about 3 feet tall.
Mm-hmm. And they have big blade, leaf blades, right?
Yeah.
So German bearded iris are going to like the similar conditions of the little blue stem a native because they want really good drainage. They don't want to be wet. Those rhizomes just will rot right up, and problems with disease stuff if you have a wet area around German bearded iris. And so maybe by taking some of your very favorites, grouping them, and maybe a little, maybe make it an interesting little shape to the bed that you're going to use. But now we're going to reduce the number of irises. We're going to take our favorites, maybe mix them in with some little blue stem, and maybe you put in some coreopsis, some tick seed that doesn't need any deadheading. My favorite one that blooms for 8 weeks with no deadheading, pollinator friendly, insects love them, is a tick seed, a coreopsis called Mercury Rising,
ooh,
which has a really blue-red petals with bright yellow domes. So you get this, you get the beautiful color of the skinny blue stems for later season into fall. You have that striking look of the German bearded iris when they're in their glory in the spring. And then the red coreopsis Mercury Rising, kind of a blue-red, that's going to carry color from the 1st of July until the end of August for flowers for your pollinators. So maybe that's another theme I'm doing, less is more, not working with as many different varieties, sharpshooting for some really high-interest, long-interest plants that require little input. And so maybe using just a group of three different varieties of perennials that will give you four seasons of interest, because the grasses are lovely in the winter, so are the tick seed. They provide a great food source for songbirds and others. Their seed heads in the fall and winter, and just doing it that way. So you're gonna make the tough choice to save the best that you like, and then what you do, so you don't have to dig those all up. I found this to be a great way to do it. I invite friends, I'm sure many people have Googled those gardens when they're seeing them in bloom.
And I'm going to stop you there, Carrie. We have to go into a break for news. We're listening to Carrie Ann Mendes, a garden designer. This is the Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent, sitting in for Larry today. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Kate Archer Kent, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on this edition of Garden Talk. Carrie Ann Mendes is staying with us. Carrie Ann's gardening consulting business is called Perennial Yours, and she writes books and articles on low-maintenance gardening. We're going to go back to the calls here, and Jim from Larson. Jim, you sound like you have perhaps some solutions to Teresa's hosta problem.
I had a similar problem. Up north where I lived at, always hostas, they were deer food, but we still grew them. But anyway, I had a light pole out front, and I could not get anything to grow around that at all. If I did, it was always real spotted and stuff, and then where my electricity went into my house, I couldn't get anything to grow. So I'm wondering if that could be the same situation. It's always really isolated. It's just a small little patch, but it's right where it went into the house.
There also could be perhaps concrete in the soil, maybe, or she might have had a downspout, perhaps, that not, you know, realizing draining right into those. So lots of different things could be going on with the hostas. But Jim, you've been sticking with your hostas regardless of deer food?
Oh yeah, between the deer and the bear. I always have to replace all my bird feeders all the time, but it always keeps things entertaining. And we got three little ankle biters that keeps them entertained all night long, too.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, Horticulture Magazine actually, I think it was 2 years ago, they released a study they were doing in their trial area where they were using milk and water, a combination of milk and water sprayed on hosta leaves to keep deer from eating them. And they found that to be highly effective for keeping deer from eating the hosta. And what a cheap way of doing it. They recommend, and you can Google this, it's out, because it's usually used as a fungicide to reduce fungal problems when you use milk and water on leaves. But this was found to be very effective as a deer repellent, and a combination of whole milk that has more fat in it, fatty substance, so to speak, to adhere to the leaves better. And ratios vary, but typically you hear one part milk to two parts water put into a mister bottle and then misted on the leaves of your hosta. And my gosh, it's not an expensive thing to try, and it could be very effective for you.
Have you tried something on them, Jim?
No. I'm sorry, what?
Have you tried anything on your hostas to deter?
Yeah. Different things. Never anything that really worked at all. So, we just kind of put up with it there a little bit. But I'm definitely going to try that milk and water.
Yeah. And, Plant Skid is another product that I think highly of. I don't know if you've used it, but it has gotten in my audiences where I travel and in my speaking, many people have just raved also about Plant Skid with blood as one of the active ingredients to be incredibly effective for both deer and rabbit. It's a Swedish company that created this patented product, and it's spelled Plant Skydd, and it's just really coming more and more into garden centers now. People are discovering it.
Well, good. Excellent. I'm going to try the milk and water first because my wife doesn't like to have anything foreign on any of the plants or anything. And that's more natural. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. Let's go on now to Shirley in Oconomowoc. Shirley, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Listen, I am just today thinking about my hydrangeas and what do I do to make them survive through winter? I've had times where I cut them back. In fact, I cut back two of them so severely that they didn't have anything to grow. I didn't get any flowers at all this summer. And I looked up online, and they said not to cut them back, but to put like a fence around it and then fill the fence with leaves, mm-hmm. and then see how it is in the summer, in the spring.
Right.
And just cut back to the first notch where it looks, the stem still looks healthy.
Right. So I would say that your frustration and what most people's frustration is with one group of hydrangea called the commonly called big leaf hydrangea or commonly called mop head hydrangea. They're in the macrophylla group. The point being is every single variety in that group, every single cultivar, they all form their flower buds late summer, early fall. So they're going to be kind of like your forsythia, your lilacs, your magnolia. They're already got their beautiful flowers in place to pop open the next year. And many varieties of hydrangeas can be very sensitive to freezing off in the winter, either from very cold temperatures or high wind chill factors, especially if they're in the path of winter winds. And the other thing that causes such loss of flowers on these is when we get into like late winter, early springs, where we have incredible temperature fluctuations that trick these hydrangeas to have those flowers starting to break open, to start like, okay, we can start growing, it's getting warm, and then bang, we get that drop in temperatures, and it just stresses out the flower buds and we lose them. So your comment about wrapping these hydrangeas, I used to do it a lot. I don't do it as much anymore. I've made some different choices with some of my plants. But I would take a chicken wire, and I would take a hoop of chicken wire around my hydrangea after it had dropped all of its leaves, just sitting there naked in the fall. I would wrap it with chicken wire, a hoop around it. I would take leaves that I was raking up, especially oak leaves, not maple tree leaves. I'm talking about leaves like oak and others that curl so that they don't mat down around the shrub. And I would pile these oak leaves inside, or you could do chipped maple leaves, inside the hoop around all those little pretty flower buds that were already formed there. So it was an insulating nest around those flower buds, protecting them from the winter. And it also did help to protect from some of the fluctuating temperatures in late winter, early spring. And that has been for many, that has been pretty reliable if you do that. The time to prune, because so many people make the mistake of pruning these mop heads at the wrong time in that kind of desperation to try to get flowers, thinking maybe if I prune them, they'll flower. But the only time you should prune those mop head big leaf hydrangeas is would be sometime late summer. I usually say before the 1st of September, to do any type of pruning to reduce size at that point before they really heavily start going into flower bud production for the following year. The one other comment I would say is this, and I know it's probably not what you want to hear, but one of two things I have done when I right-size my gardens, I made the choice to get rid of, donate, give away, sell a lot of those mop head hydrangeas like Endless Summer and others that frustrated the dickens out of me. And I did one of two things. I started using more of what are called mountain hydrangeas that many garden centers are selling now. They're just a different subgroup in the hydrangea family, but they've been found to have a much better bud hardiness, flower bud hardiness, than Endless Summers and the other. And they go under the common name of mountain hydrangeas. And when you'd see them, you would probably notice very little difference from your common mop heads, other than the leaves of the mountain are a little bit smaller, a little darker colored. But those have been more reliable, especially for colder zones and wintering over the flowers. And the second thing I've done, I've started just using a lot more of other varieties of hydrangeas, like panicle hydrangeas and others that have white or pink or other color flowers, and just you know, saying I'm willing to go more in the direction of those that form their flower buds in the spring. I don't have to worry about how wicked cold our winters are. And any of these other ones that have the white flowers or pink blush flowers are highly drought tolerant. And your mop head hydrangeas, as you know, by mid-afternoon, especially if there are a lot of sun, they're wilting because they lose so much water off of those big leaves.
Well, Shirley, good luck to you. You've got some options there, and thanks so much for calling. We've had a number of comments on Facebook. Laura recommends an app called Garden that identifies flowers and butterflies just by photographing them.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Have you used any of these apps?
No, I have not, and it's called Garden, and you can...
Yeah, you take a picture, and then it'll tell you what it is that you're looking at in your garden.
Oh, wonderful. No, I didn't know that. Thank you.
And then George on Facebook says he turns his garden over in the fall and spring, and he wants to know if there's any benefit to the fall turnover. What do you think?
I don't know what turnover means. Does that mean I'm thinking like a vegetable area, an edible, where a lot of these plants are now finished for the season? I'm not talking about the perennial.
Yeah, I think that,
And so then you're adding organic matter. I think that's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, leaf matter, leaf mold, and you're working it into the soil so that it breaks down for the following spring, which is great, so it's ready to plant. I think that's fine, although I will say there's been more and more information out that we should not be working and tilling our soil like we used to think we were supposed to do, because it continues to break down the structure of the soil particles. So we almost get, after years of tilling, the soil almost becomes like it's silty. It has no structure. It doesn't hold well. And that's why a lot of the big commercial growers now, you're not seeing a lot of these guys doing as much tilling through the fields for their crops. They're using more cover crops and other ways to enrich soil, to break up soil without using big tines that are always ripping up and breaking through that soil year after year after year. So,
yeah, so some things to think about there.
Yeah, but organic matter certainly will help. But remember, organic matter is not the same thing as soil particles, rock particles. That's different, and people think of soil as one thing, and it's really the mix of organic material as well as rock particles, if you will, that are non-living or weren't living. Yeah, anyway.
We're talking with Carrie Ann Mendez, a garden designer and author of The Right Size Flower Garden, Simplify Your Outdoor Space with Smart Design Solutions and Plant Choices. If you have a question, perhaps you might be downsizing your garden, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Mabel in Duluth. Hi, Mabel.
Hi. I was out of the room, and I came into the kitchen and just caught them talking about the hydrangeas. And 2 years ago, my son gave me a big, beautiful endless summer, and I planted it up against the foundation. And then after a freeze, we had our first freeze last night, I will go out and cover it with bags of leaves, and it does just beautifully. I think they need a little bit more warmth from the house. You can't just plant them out anywhere you want them. But if you put them by the house, they'll survive.
Yeah, I find that you're right. Sometimes you can bump up a zone, if you will, to a warmer zone by using the foundation or other or rocks and stones that will store heat and then reflect heat during the evenings, which just that little bit can sometimes help get some plants through that could be borderline, including flower buds. But I would say I wouldn't be putting it on the west side of the house if that side of the house is getting blasted by western winds in the winter. So, yeah, I agree putting plants up against the side of the house certainly can be very helpful to help provide a little microclimate, but it would be which direction on the house. I would be planting them on the east side of the house and maybe the southeast side of the house. I wouldn't be putting them on the west side of the house if I had strong winds that were, it didn't have any kind of wind break to stop that wind from blasting into the plants on the west side of the house.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mabel. Let's go to one question here by email. James in Eau Claire is asking for scientific names of Japanese forest grass and bottlebrush shrub. He says many common names don't agree across regions.
Right. I agree. And that's why I don't like to always sputter but the botanical names because sometimes it's just, you know, like who are we talking? It just doesn't make sense to a lot of people.
You're safe here.
So this is what I usually try to do, the combo. So the botanical name, you're right, because common names can vary dramatically in regions. But the botanical name for the Japanese forest grass is Hakanokloa. And Hakanokloa is spelled Hakonecloa. So that's your Latin, your botanical name for Japanese forest grass. The botanical name for bottle brush shrub is Fothergilla, and that's Fothergilla, Fothergilla.
Excellent.
And then there's different species groups within that, but that's the genus.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Rick in Madison. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Rick.
Hi. Hello. I love Garden Talk, by the way. Thank you. I was just wondering if you had any opinions about oak leaf hydrangeas. I haven't done a lot of research yet about them, but I live in the Madison area and was hoping to plant some next year at a new house.
I love oak leaf because they really are four-season hydrangea. And then I'll tell you one thing, a couple of things I'd be careful of, but oak leaf hydrangeas are the only ones that have that glorious burgundy-red foliage in the fall. So they have striking fall foliage where most other hydrangeas don't. And the second thing, they have exfoliating bark. So they have that wonderful peeling bark for winter interest, especially against snow. I mean, just it's, they're glorious. Now, having said that, and here are two things that I always think about when I'm selecting an oak leaf hydrangea. One, some of these can get very large and very wide, very tall and very wide. Many of the ones that have been on the market, commonly sold on the market, like Alice and Snow Queen, can easily go 6 to 8 feet tall, if not more, and wide. So they can get very big. And so you need to think about that. But the good news is now the breeders are downsizing the size, and there's been a whole slew of new varieties of oak leaves that are 6 feet or shorter and also much less wide, so they can fit in smaller spaces, even in container urns, and look very striking. So be aware of the size issues, and if you need something smaller, look for the ones that don't get as big and wide. The second thing is, in zones 5, and I think that's probably you're either 5, 6, but I'm in zone 5 here, I'm very careful to site them where they're not going to be exposed to winter wind, because I find that, that they can be sometimes borderline in zone 5, and they can be stressed more easily than some of the other hydrangeas. So with any of my oak leaves, I try to give them protection from a lot of winter winds. That's the only other thing I think of when I'm citing those.
Hope that helps, Rick. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Eunice in Dodgeville. Hi, Eunice.
Hi.
Hi, Eunice.
My question is, I've been given a trumpet plant, and it's in a large container.
Container, yeah.
And I know nothing about a trumpet plant. They tell me it's so beautiful and has yellow trumpets on it, I guess, but mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with it. Is it an indoor plant, an outdoor mm-hmm. plant, or does it live through the winter?
I'm assuming you're talking about campsis, which is a perennial vine, commonly called trumpet vine. And I'm assuming that's what you're talking about because I can't see it. It's got yellow or orangey-red flowers. It is a magnet for hummingbirds. They love it.
Really?
Oh, my gosh, yes. But I would say to be careful where you plant it because two things you need to know with these, most of these, there are certain varieties are not as aggressive, if you will, but most of them are going to get quite big, and they have twining stems, which means the entire stem is going to wrap itself around a structure it's going to need in order to climb, and they can get sometimes like a wisteria, not as big, but they can get pretty big and bulky over the years, and they can smother a support depending on what you're using to grow it on. So I bet there must be some name of that, some variety to see what variety you have to see the mature height because you want to get a sense of how big this is going to grow in order for you to select the structure you're going to give it to climb on. It might be on a arbor, a pergola, and you're going to want to put it in sun, to part sun. It's going to want to be out in there sun where all those little hummingbirds are going to just love diving at it, enjoying it. But I would, I'm sure there must be some description of the type. Most of these are going to get pretty big over the years, and you're going to want to give it that room and that stronger support, not a little twiggy support that'll be crushed over the years after this matures.
Now, are you telling me that it is an outdoor plant?
Yes, it is an outdoor plant. I can't see it, and as the earlier caller said, a lot of common names can be very confusing if we, you know, how people use it. But I'm assuming it's a trumpet plant, and the Latin name, the botanical name, is campsis, C-A-M-P-S-I-S. And if it's that, it's an outdoor vine that needs sun to part sun, and it's going to want something kind of hefty to be able to wrap itself and grow around to grow up and over.
So now, because I just got it, and it's in a container, would it be too late to plant it outdoors now?
No, absolutely. It's going dormant. I mean, it's going to be going dormant, yeah. And you're just kind of putting it to sleep in the garden. I mean, I would definitely not leave it in your house. I'd either put it into an unheated garage to let it go dormant in a colder spot in the winter, not treat it as a house plant. So move it either, if you can't get into the ground now, I would dig it into the ground. And if you don't even want to disturb the roots, given it's November, what is it, 18th? What day is it? You could just dig a hole in the ground and just sink the entire container into the ground so you're not even disturbing the roots at this point. You're just going to take that container, sink it into the insulating earth to kind of hold it there through the winter, and then in the spring when you're ready to figure out where to plant it and what to do with it, you can slip it out of the pot and then dig it into the space you want it.
Well, good luck, Eunice. That's great advice there. Carrie Ann, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Carrie Ann Mendez is the author of a number of gardening books, including The Right Size Flower Garden, Simplify Your Outdoor Space with Smart Design Solutions and Plant Choices. Thanks to Jill Nadeau for on-air production and to Michelle Good for technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who's back on Monday. Thank you for being part of the garden conversation today here on the Ideas Network. And stay with us. There's more just ahead. Chapter a Day is coming up next. Hope you have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.